Plato, Part 3. The 10th talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 16, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 4 in this series.
Gray of the Cave. What I want to do is start with Plato's Theory of Forms. I'm on page 2, part B on your notes, if you've got your notes. We'll talk about the theory of forms, and then hopefully I won't be so absent-minded that I won't remember to come back and talk about the allegory of the cave. The theory of the forms is probably the most well-known of Plato's doctrines, I would guess. If you take any philosophy class or any Plato at all, you talk about his theory of the forms. So we'll do our best to understand this. There's a lot of questions that I don't have answers to, because remember I told you that all we know of Plato is in his dialogues. We don't have his lecture notes and the more technical, sophisticated stuff. Aristotle, on the other hand, all we have are lecture notes. We don't have his dialogues, and according to Copleston, History of Philosophy, he did write dialogues, but we just don't have any. That is Aristotle. So all we have to go on with Plato are his dialogues. So since those are more popular and less technical, there are a lot of questions that you would like answers to, that the kind of popular presentation of the theory in the dialogues just doesn't answer those questions. So we just have to try to piece it together, and a lot of articles have been written on various aspects of his theory of the forms, debating back and forth what the right way to understand it is. But the basic gist of it, I think, is quite accessible. But to understand it, we have to understand a concept, the concept of sameness. There's two kinds of identity, or two kinds of sameness that are talked about by philosophers throughout the history of ideas. There's quantitative sameness and there's numerical identity. And let me explain the, did I say quantitative? Qualitative sameness. If I'm in the grocery store and I take a box of Kellogg's cornflakes off the shelf, and Jody says, "No, not that box, that box." And I say, "Why? They're the same." What she would mean by the same in that case is not that it is one and the same box. It is actually different, numerically different box. It's this one and not that one. So it's not the same in that sense, but it has all the same attributes as the other box. It looks the same. It may look absolutely indistinguishable unless one corner is crushed on one or something, but assuming that there are no distinctive differences between them, they are the same. That's qualitative sameness. Identical twins, if they're really, really, really identical, are the same, not in the sense that it's the same person, identically, numerically the same person, but they are indistinguishable from each other. Okay, so that idea is clear enough. On the other hand, numerical identity is when you mean the very one and the same being. So if I say, "He is the same man I saw at the library yesterday," I don't mean he's his identical twin or his clone and he looks just like him. What I mean is that is one and the same individual being. But do you see how confusing it is? Because we use the same language to describe both. And that's why it can get really confusing. If I say, "That's my Snickers bar, it's the same bar I had in my hand a second ago," I don't mean it looks just like any other Snickers bar. I mean, that's mine. I mean, that very bar is one and the same bar that I have claimed ownership over. Now, I think there's another kind of sameness. We won't talk about it here because it's not relevant to Plato's theory of forms, and I call it representational sameness. But the two kinds of sameness that typically get tossed back and forth and talked about throughout the history of ideas are these two, qualitative sameness and identical, numerical identity, numerical sameness. Okay, with respect to qualitative sameness, there's kind of a mystery there. Particularly, because there are all kinds of beings in the world that we call, they belong to the same category, but notice I use the word same. They belong to the same category, even though oftentimes the differences are more striking than the similarities. Or arguably, they are more striking. So look at this list I have here. Think in terms of a Saint Bernard, a Mexican Chihuahua, a cartoon drawing of a dog like, who's the dog? Pluto? The Disney character. We immediately recognize that's a dog, that's a dog, Pluto's a dog. All these individuals are dogs, but look how different they are. A St. Bernard, Mexican Chihuahua, a cartoon drawing. They're very, very different in their attributes, and yet somehow, some way, we have recognized in them something's the same about them. Dog, dog, dog. Well, for Plato, that was something of a mystery. What is it that's the same in all of those things, such that we class them in the same category and recognize and acknowledge that they belong to the same category? What is the same sameness of their sameness? Well, Plato's answer is that they all participate in, that's one of the favorite verbs that he uses. Obviously, the question is participate in. What does it mean to participate in? But nonetheless, that's the language he uses. They all participate in one and the same form. Or sometimes he calls it an idea, and sometimes he calls it an arche, a universal, a foundational principle. That they all, because they all participate in one and the same, and I'll just call it form, because they participate in one and the same form, that's what makes them the same. That's why they belong to the same category. So notice what he's doing is he's explaining qualitative sameness by an underlying numerical identity, sameness of a numerical identity. Because they all are connected to literally one in the same thing, one in the same being, it's that connection with one in the same being that makes them qualitatively the same, because it's only numerically one form that they all participate in. So an interesting move that he makes. Now, his basic insight in the theory of forms, and this is controversial, philosophy hasn't always followed Plato with this. This is, we moderns are less likely to follow Plato on this than most of human history has been. But his basic insight was that what came to be known as universals. So let me explain what a universal is. If you had four dogs on each table around the room here, those are particulars. There's that dog, that dog, that dog, that dog, that dog, that dog, that dog. Each of those is their own individual being. They are a particular being. Well, when you can use a word, a category, that applies to all those particulars, the word that philosophers typically use is that's a universal. That is, it is universally applicable to each particular in its domain, each particular that belongs to that class. The category universally applies to them. Well, universals are concepts, Plato says, that actually have a standing in reality. There is dogness. There is tableness. There is tree-ness and mountain-ness, that you don't, you, not only do you have individual mountains, so particular mountains exist, sure, but not only do you have individual mountains existing, but mountainness itself exists. It actually has a standing in reality. Now, that then becomes very controversial. We'll jump ahead in history. When you get to the Middle Ages, what the hottest debate going among the scholastics in the Middle Ages and the philosophers in the Middle Ages was what they call the problem of universals. That is, what's the nature of a universal? Is it the case, like Plato says, that it actually exists? Or, during the Middle Ages arose a different view. It wasn't completely original. You have some earlier philosophies who said a similar thing, but where it really takes off is in the Middle Ages, a position called nominalism. And nominalism says, let's take dogmas for example. Dogmas doesn't exist as a thing in the world. Dogmas is just a word. It's just a name. We human beings have invented this name. You know, I could talk about that dog, that dog, that dog, that dog, that dog, that dog all day long, but isn't it more convenient to be able to just use one name, one label, one word, and kind of gather them all together? Because it might be convenient for some reason to gather them all together. So what we human beings have done is we human beings have invented a name, a nomen. That's where nominalism comes from. We've invented a name that makes it very convenient and doable to group particular beings in together for the sake of identifying them as a group rather than as individuals. But it's not like the name designates anything that actually exists. There is no such thing as dogness. It's just a convenient device. It's just a word, nothing but a word. Does it exist as a word? Yeah, it exists as a word. But it only exists as a word, not as a reality in and of itself. The word's not pointing to anything beyond itself. Is that clear? Well, that's diametrically the opposite position of Plato. What Plato is saying is, no, dogness is a dog points to a reality that exists in and of itself in reality above and beyond any particular dog, this dog or that dog. So let me go back to the Middle Ages for a second. There was the one position that followed Plato in the Middle Ages, it was called realism, that dogness really existed. Nominalism says, no, it doesn't really exist. It's just a name. There is a middle position called moderate realism. Moderate realism was a position of St. Thomas Aquinas. It probably was the dominant position. And the moderate realist said, dogness really exists, but it doesn't exist out there in reality somewhere. It can only exist in the particular dog or in the mind of a human being who knows that a dog is a dog. I mean, he has grasped the dogness of that particular thing in order to be able to assert that as a dog, and then ultimately in the mind of God. In the mind of God, dogness exists. It seems to me that now, the reason that was a different position than the realist position is because one interpretation of Plato, probably the right one, because it seems to be a position that Aristotle criticizes. One way of interpreting Plato is that he actually existed, he actually believed that the forms exist somewhere. And, I mean, think of it as a parallel universe or a vault up in the heavens somewhere where the forms existed, such that if you were to destroy every dog in the universe and you were to destroy every human being so that there's no human being who can have the idea of dogness in it, and if a god existed, if you could destroy the god who has the idea in his mind, you still got a boatload of forms out there somewhere. They still exist in some parallel universe or in some vault somewhere. That's the extreme realist position, and arguably may have been Plato's position. I'm not so sure, but maybe. The moderate realist position is realizing, well, that doesn't really make any sense. You know, there's not a parallel universe with dogness and treeness and mountainous and so on stuff in it. But it does make sense that dogness actually exists as an idea in the mind of God, as an idea that we human beings grasp. And certainly we're seeing individual particular things that are informed by that form, whose being is actually defined and shaped by dogness and in any other form.
When Carl von Linné came along and decided to categorize plants and animals,
oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Was that form or was it nominalism? For instance, the genus Canis is all those critters that have dogness about them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different species, but they all belong to this group that he calls Canis,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, humans are great pigeonholers.
Right.
And I think Linné was probably the biggest pigeonholer of them all, maybe. So is that form or is it nominalism? I mean, there's name we have.
But the one to ask would be Charlie.
Okay.
Charlie would have a ready answer to that question. I'm trying to remember what I've heard him say. I think Linnaeus, for him, that's form. For Kant, Immanuel Kant, it's form, kind of, in a different kind of sense. What's happened in modern times is modern evolutionists have adopted the nominalist perspective. And so I remember hearing a debate once that it goes way back before I even understood some of these things, and so I didn't quite know what they were debating. But thinking back now I realize what they were debating, because the evolutionists, the Darwinists in the audience, were saying there is no such thing as a species. Species are arbitrary, they said. There's no distinction between kinds, and whoever was arguing against them was trying to argue for the inability for something to evolve from one kind into another kind. And they weren't even debating him at that level. They were saying kind. That's just completely arbitrary. It's not like there are kinds that actually, see what they're saying? There aren't actually kinds that actually exist in reality. We have put a box, or as you called it, a pigeonhole. We've created a pigeonhole and decided which particulars go into it. But we could have done that differently. Is what they were arguing.
Were they indirectly arguing against God? Is that an argument against God?
The nominalists?
Yeah.
Well, not originally, although it is interesting in the Middle Ages, the ones that were nominalists on the issue of universals tended to be the rather, I don't know what else to call them other than more modern and secular on theological issues. They weren't very conservative theologically. And some of them were downright non-Christians theologically. So there was some correlation there. But it wouldn't have to be, I don't think. Well, I mean, maybe ultimately I'd want to argue that it did have to be, because my position would be that the modern realists during the Middle Ages were right. I mean, that just makes all the sense in the world to me. That to talk about something like dogness being something that actually has reality in the mind of God, that just makes sense. So, and then God is the one who creates the particular in keeping with, in conformity with that concept, with that idea. So he makes a dog to be a dog because it conforms to his intention to make a dog, which is a concept he has and which he understands and which is a reality in his mind. So he creates a dog to be a particular form of that concept.
So it might not be a coincidence that nominalists and evolutionists argue against dogness.
Right.
There's some connection they see.
Right.
But
well,
you're not seeing a direct argument against it necessarily.
I mean, I'd probably talk myself into it if I kept talking, because What's attractive about nominalism? What's attractive about nominalism is I created the category, a human being, I created the categories. I did so arbitrarily. I did so for my purposes. Well, you don't need God if you're the creator of those categories. But if those categories transcend you, a human being, then you got to explain where they came from. Now, there would be people who could just say, well, they're eternal. Plato didn't think they were created. He just thought they were eternal. They've always been there, always will be there. They just have being in and of themselves. So you could believe in the forms without God, but, you know, bring us down to a Christian context. If I'm not the creator and the categories actually transcend me, then how am I going to account for why they exist? The most available thing in Christian worldview is God.
And maybe in some sense that reminds me that I'm a creation, and and that maybe is offensive in some way.
If I look at there were several dogs, right? The picture of the dog, you know, the Mexican Chihuahua, etc. What unites them is that they share some characteristics, right? I mean, instead of legs, they had tentacles, and they looked like an octopus, I would be talking about octopusness.
You would.
But also, it also seems like when you're talking about that, you end up in this eternal regression of nisness, because if I'm talking about dogness and I have to talk about the niss of the dogness, I seem to be implying that there's always some kind of stuff behind the form of something else. I mean, it's like an eternal regression of ideas.
I'm not sure I'm following you. That's actually Aristotle's argument, but I'm not sure I'm following you. What?
Well, I mean, if I say dogness actually exists in concrete reality, well, what defines dogness? What defines dogness is some kind of nissness. I'm really stretching the English language, but there's some stuff that makes up.
Maybe this is what you mean, because this is this is Aristotle's critique of Plato.
Yep.
He says, okay, so you've got dogness, and you've got a particular dog, and why is it that you identify the dog as participating in dogness? Is it because you see something the same in the particular dog with dogness? I think this is your point. You know, if you define that, well, then don't you have to explain the sameness of the particular dog and dogness by the same device that you explained the particular dogs and dogness? Namely, there's something outside of them that they both participate in. And then you do, in fact, get an infinite regress.
I think that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And I don't know. I guess that sounds weird to me.
I would defend Plato by saying to Aristotle,
Aristotle does not believe in Plato's concrete forms, and he uses it.
He believes forms exist.
Okay, but he believes in the eternal regression or whatever.
Aristotle is easier than Plato. It's difficult. See, what Aristotle is doing is pointing to a seeming difficulty in Plato. But Plato's using such use language and metaphor and that kind of thing that to get him on a use of a metaphor when it's just a metaphor, I don't know how fair that is, really. I don't know if Plato has to be held to... I don't think you can call him inconsistent if he thinks that you can recognize that a dog is participating in dogness without an external form to compare the two. I mean, why would he need that?
Sure.
I'm not sure that that follows. Because what he's trying to account for is what's the same in all these particular beings that are so different from each other? What's the same then? Well, arguably, there's nothing that different between a dog and dogness. Whatever dogness is, however you might define it, it may be relatively straightforward without some kind of comparative standard outside of the two things. It might be relatively straightforward to recognize, but a dog is a dog. That's why I say it belongs to dogness, because a dog is a dog.
I mean, it seems like from my perspective, as the person looking into the world and seeing the dogs and seeing the different categories of existence, that I look out and I see patterns. And so I look at the attributes that characterize what we might call dogness, and I say, while there is diversity within this category, this larger umbrella category is dog. But then, you know, if we were to break it down, okay, there's German Shepherd dogs, okay, there's Golden Retriever dogs, there's Mexican Chihuahua dogs, okay, so we break down the categories. Well, you know, there's different Chihuahuas. Some Mexican Chihuahuas do look different from
each other. You have to distinguish those from barking rats.
And from barking rats. And so we're going to be talking about Chihuahua-ness. I mean, I'm really liking this NIS with Chihuahua-ness. I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, I guess what I mean, though, is it does seem like from my perspective, there is a certain degree of arbitrariness if we're beginning with me. But if we're beginning with God and we're talking about God as the origin of the universe, and we're talking about God having created all things, and that the patterns and the categories carry some logic behind them and reason, then that reason, right, would find its origin in God. And so I guess from God's perspective, you could say the forms exist in his mind, but then they still don't exist in a vault or an alternative universe.
Right.
And they don't exist in any concrete form, God. And you could even say, can God make a whole bunch of dogs and not have a thought of dogness and just make everything? Is that even possible? I mean,
yeah, my contention is no.
No,
that God cannot create a boatload of dogs without a concept of dogness.
Of dogness.
And so you're putting your finger on a vital issue that I think, coming to the Bible, I don't think we can understand the Bible unless we become old-fashioned enough, because this is not the modern trend in our culture and in academia and in philosophy and in science or anything. But for most of human history, people were very comfortable believing in the existence of ideas. And what I mean by that is that things that did not have matter and substance, they were not concrete. You couldn't drop them on the floor and break them. They weren't that kind of thing. They weren't made of material. They were a mental creation, a mental object. But mental object though it is, it's as real as can be. It exists, and it's an existing thing that has to be reckoned with. Well, my contention is that's very much compatible with the biblical worldview. That for something to merely be an idea created by God isn't somehow unreal or lacking in being or lacking in reality or whatever. If God thought it into existence, and he thought it into existence without having material concrete form, then okay, it doesn't have material concrete form, but it's still an existing reality. It still is what it is and a part of God's creation. And a lot of modern Christians get all tripped up because their education has taught them to be thoroughgoing materialists. The only thing that's real is something that's concrete, made of matter, made of stuff, and you can kick it and it hurts your toe. If it's not concrete in that way, then it's somehow not real, or not as real, or not real enough to count, or, you know, the whatever. But to be thoroughgoing idealists, I think, is essential in order to really understand the biblical worldview, because I think the Bible would promote hardcore real idealism.
Just a quick aside, an example or two of the modern Christian under the influence of materialism, where he's tripped up by that, where he can't conceive of there being the existence of the reality unless it's concrete.
You want me to give an example?
Do you have anything in mind there?
Let's see. Well, take something like how probably most Christians think about the soul. Most Christians think about, or at least talk about, the soul as if it were a quasi-material thing. It's not, see, an idea doesn't exist in any place, for example. It's difficult for Christians to think of there being realities that don't exist in any place. The Holy Spirit, for that matter. Well, is the Holy Spirit here or here? Or, and if the Holy Spirit is in all of us, is it also in the middle of the, I mean, the way we think about it, I think the way we tend to think about it, is the Holy Spirit has to be in a place. Not just its effects in a place, but the Holy Spirit has to be in a place. Well, that's thinking like a materialist. The human soul has to be in a place. That's thinking like a materialist. When we get to the creation of the universe, most Christians would look at Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and assume that the heavens and the earth is all there is to God's creation and explains everything about the cosmos that God created. So the physical cosmos, that's what is. And that's what God created. And then to think in terms of God being kind of on a par with his creation, such that that becomes the furniture within his realm that he lives with. So he has to deal with the creation just like we have to deal with the creation. It's just the thing that exists now that is a part of his reality, as opposed to being something that God believed and spoke into existence, thought and spoke into existence. He spoke it into existence having material attributes. But although it had what we call material attributes, it's not matter to him. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have substance that he has to account for and deal with and interact with. He couldn't stub his toe on the cosmos.
Would this fit? I remember reading, there's a philosopher at Iola, William Lane Craig, mm-hmm. and I remember him saying that prior to God creating the cosmos, he was without time, but at the point of creation, God entered time.
Okay.
And became, not a creature, became God, but within time. Or is that something else?
Is that something else? Time bugs me. I can't live with it, and I can't live without it. We easily and readily make the claim that God exists outside of time or did exist out of time, depending upon the position people take. Okay, maybe. The problem is I have no way of understanding that. And I can't conceive. How do you have duration outside of time? So did God exist without enduring before creation? That makes no sense to me. And I'm not saying it's false. I'm just saying
You just got to get out of the box, Jack. You just got to make that philosophical leap.
That's what I was going to say. Can you make the philosophical leap?
I'd gladly make
like
the philosophical
God being the
leap.
Author of a book.
I'd gladly make the philosophical leap if I had any direction for where to leap to.
I think mine's a simple question. So I know I was trained by my culture to be a materialist.
Mm-hmm.
So did a guy in the 15th century, were the original readers of the Bible, were they not, did they not have the same stumbling blocks as me?
Right, I would say no. I don't
think
so.
They weren't infected by the Greeks to be materialist?
Greeks are not materialists. Plato's not a materialist.
Okay.
They're dualists.
So
hardcore materialism doesn't begin until the Enlightenment. In the 1700s.
So some guy in the 15th century might have not thought of the Holy Spirit as some kind of quasi-physical thing then, or his soul or something like that. He wouldn't have naturally gone there.
Right.
Because I so naturally go there, I can't imagine not naturally going there.
Right. Remember the so-called debate in the Middle Ages, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Well, what was that question? What was it seeking to establish? What it was seeking to establish is that angels don't take up space. It's Okay, well, they're thinking of angels not as a quasi-body, not as a quasi-material being, but as an entirely different kind of thing. It doesn't even take up space.
They were still aware. They were still aware of the question, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right.
I'm saying I probably wasn't even aware of the question.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying.
Point.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Ideas being concrete forms, isn't that unfalsifiable? Either direction. Ideas being concrete forms, isn't that unfalsifiable either direction? So to say that ideas, I mean, to say that they have no form, what you were talking about ideas having a form that stands alone from the forms, that whole thing, I mean, isn't that unfalsifiable? You can't really do anything with that either way. I can't test.
I'm sorry, are you going back to the Aristotle critique or the issue of...
I don't think I'm going back to the Aristotle critique.
Okay.
I think I'm just talking about the idea that dogness exists.
Okay.
Right, you can't quantify that. And so you're saying the materialist problem is that you can't quantify that. Is that what you're saying?
I don't recognize what I said.
Okay.
I'm just trying to make the point that we moderns, because of our education and our acculturation, are really, really resistant, maybe even allergic to the idea of giving reality to mere ideas. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think without really thinking about it all that much, we think that ideas are just something that a human mind creates to kind of like the nominalist position. Well, yeah, we have ideas, but they're just in my head. They don't actually exist in reality. They're not a part of the reality that we have to navigate. And we're kind of allergic to the idea of letting there be an idea that actually informs reality and exists in reality, that is above me, beyond me, outside of me, that I'm answerable to.
So you're answerable to dogness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how that has any relationship with the God argument from before about whether or not there is a God. I don't see how that's relevant, I guess. I mean,
I don't either.
Okay.
I didn't think I was addressing that issue. Anyway.
No, now you're not. I'm just thinking all over the place. I'll let you continue because
I need to
think through this.
What I mean by I'm answerable to it is if I look at an alligator and call it a dog, I'm wrong. There's an idea that I'm answerable to. Dogs participate in dogness. Alligators don't. And to the extent that I have to discover or make a claim about that, I have to answer to that. I can't ignore it. Okay. Okay, the other thing that Plato said, not only that ideas have actually existence and being in reality, but the universals, the forms, are actually somehow more real, really, than the particulars to which they apply. Now that, on the one hand, I think that's very insightful because I think that's very true. On the other hand, when you fit it into Plato's whole worldview, his worldview is pretty kind of distinctively wrong, I think, because in Plato's worldview, you had a hierarchy, a gradation, real, less real, less real, less real, less real, and you get barely real at all. When you get to Neoplatonism, a philosophy invented 300 years after Jesus, who by a guy who picked up Plato's writings and really ran with them, it's called Neoplatonism. There you really see very dramatically Plato's scheme, hierarchical scheme, because Plotinus, the Neoplatonist, believed that everything was ultimately, everything was one, just this brimming full of being one. And it was so brimming full of being that it began to spill over. And as being spilled out of the fountain of being and spilled over and fell away from being, and that's the language he uses, as it falls away from being, it becomes, the further away it falls, the less being it has, the less real it is, until you get to what we call the world, which barely has any being at all. That is very foreign to us, but I also think it's very false. That is a categorically false perspective on the worldview and not at all compatible with a biblical worldview. But I do think there's a basic insight behind what Plato's saying that is compatible with what the Bible is saying. And that is that Plato's notion that what gives being, that there really are two kinds of being. There's being that can't not be, and there's being that could not be. Philosophers make a distinction between necessary being and contingent being. Well, I exist, but I could have not existed. If the world had gone a little differently, I never would have come into existence. And I exist now, but I wouldn't have to exist tomorrow or next year. That my being is vulnerable to not being. That's contingent being, contingent existence. God, I think, arguably, has necessary being. He couldn't not be in any meaningful sense that we could wrap our mind around. We can't conceive of his being as being contingent being. Well, what's more real then? Certainly God is more real than we are if we use real the way Plato's using the word real. What is more vulnerable to going out of existence? We are. God is not at all vulnerable to going out of existence. So to have God and that which is created or a product of God's mind is certainly more real than any particular instantiation of that. And I think that's what Plato was trying to capture, and I think he's right about that. You know, dogness is going to still exist in the mind of God, even if you wiped out every dog on the planet. God could always take that which is more real that he has created, dogness, and make some more.
He could take down somebody's rib.
Yeah.
I just think that even we find extinct animals interesting and dig up dinosaur bones and whatnot.
Yeah, so, even though we only grasp them. Mm-hmm. In idea form.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Questions, comments on that?
Jack, when you're saying the ideas or whatever, that things you can't put your hand on or grasp in reality, mm-hmm. Well, can you give examples of what we're talking about there? I mean, things like the Holy Spirit and soul, even God himself, are those ideas that we have in our, do you understand what I'm?
Well,
Because I'm not sure what you mean exactly when you're saying that ideas, you know, aren't real or whatever. So okay. Can you give examples of that?
Okay. Well, a great example would be take the idea that informs me, Jackness. Could anyone invent a Jack extractor that sucks the Jackness right out of me? I don't think so, because it's not the kind of thing that can be extracted. It's not a material thing. It's not even a translucent, invisible, intangible material thing. See, that's what we tend to do, is we think if an idea has reality, then it has reality because it has matter that's not matter-like. It's translucent, it's invisible, it's intangible, it's not concrete, but there is stuff. Has to be stuff, because if there is no stuff, then it doesn't have any existence, right? And I'm saying, well, no, there is no stuff that makes me Jack. What makes me Jack is my creator, God, directing and determining what I say, what I do, what I think, everything about who I am to create a pattern of behaviors, a pattern of character and stuff like that. Well, a pattern doesn't exist as stuff, but it exists. It's a very real thing. the pattern of my behavior and the pattern of my desires and the pattern of my speech and so on is very, very real. But it's not stuff. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
As opposed to what?
That just seems rather shallow to define yourself as patterns.
I'm not as deep as you think I am. Well, I mean, even take something like personality. You can't have a personality-ectomy. You know, you can't go in there and cut out the personality. The personality doesn't exist as a thing. It's an idea that informs my behavior and my desires and everything. So is that better? I mean, personality.
Better. It's a little deeper.
I'm still. Can you go? So what about things like the Holy Spirit and soul and I mean how does that?
Well, okay. Soul. I think I just used an example of soul. Jackness is my soul. So I don't think you could make a soul extractor to suck the soul out of a person either, because I don't think soul is the kind of thing that you can suck out of a person. There's no stuff there to suck out. It's simply a way of describing the person that is me, the person that I am. And how does that work its way out in the world? Through what I do with my hands, what I do with my mouth, what I do with my feet, what I do with my head. That there is no soul other, there is no material manifestation of the soul except in my body. It's what my body does. But see, that's not how we have typically thought of it. We think of, I mean, growing up, I thought my soul was the Casper the Friendly Ghost that lived inside of me. And, you know, you see pictures of Casper floating out of the body and having a disembodied experience and then coming back in or something, and that's the soul. Notice how we're thinking of it in material terms. It's a little quasi-body that exists in space. You can poke your hand through it, but so it's a different kind of stuff, but it's stuff. Spatially located stuff. And I'm saying that's not really what the soul is, and that's nothing in the Bible suggests that that's what the soul is. We're the ones that have imposed that on it. The soul is simply a way of describing when my body is not a dead corpse, when it's actually a living, animated person, it's the person that animates the body. But it doesn't animate the body by pulling the strings of the body. It's not another body inside of my body that has different existence and real existence. My body is doing what my Creator ultimately determines that it will do. And in the process of doing that, it defines my person. My person comes into being through what I choose, how I act, what I say. Now, I've gone beyond Plato, because I think Plato, when it comes to the soul, his concept of the soul is kind of difficult. It's hard to know, because there are dialogues, it's hard. There's a debate in one of the dialogues. If you die on a windy day, is there a possibility the wind will blow your soul away? And so you don't want to die on a windy day. But he's critiquing that idea. I mean, it's not what he believes, but that kind of thinking was current, at least.
There's stuff there.
Exactly.
I was just wondering if you're saying that a soul doesn't have to exist in a certain time and place, so a soul doesn't have to have being, I think is how he phrases it. And a soul can exist without being.
Well, I think from a biblical perspective, you can't have a human soul apart from a human body. So, yes, a human soul has to exist in a certain time and place, because if you have no body, you have no soul. So wherever the body, at whatever time and place the body is, that's in effect where the soul is, because the soul is simply the life of the person that's being expressed through that body. But if you got rid of the body, you wouldn't have got rid of the soul, And that comes back to my original point, because it's an idea in the mind of God. God knows who Jack is. God knows who he set out to create Jack to be. He doesn't forget who he created Jack to be. So that's why I would argue, if when we die, I think our body goes in the grave and my soul, if you will, my Jackness, ceases to exist in any expressed form in reality until God resurrects me. And I have all the confidence in the world that it will be me he resurrects, because he hasn't forgotten who Jack is. And he's fully capable of giving a new body that will give expression, continuous expression, to his concept of Jack that he brought into being in the first place. It's that same Jack he's going to resurrect and give life to and give personhood to. And that, I think, soul is just is the old-fashioned word for what we call person. A person is a soul.
So I have personhood.
Sorry?
So I have personhood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is not metaphysical. This is an idea in God's mind that then patterns my existence.
Not metaphysical. An idea in the mind of God is metaphysical.
Okay, so it is metaphysical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, when you look at my personhood, my personhood's in my brain.
Your personhood's in your brain?
Yeah. if you
knock... Have you told that to anybody yeah. else?
If you knock me on the head hard enough, my personhood might change.
I gotcha. Okay. So in you literally mean in the brain.
Yeah, your brain is my soul.
Okay. Okay.
So if you hit me really hard, I could become a totally different person. I mean, I would have personality changes. I mean, it depends on where you hit me and how. Don't be trying. I mean, that kind of stuff happens. How do you account for that? If my personhood is something metaphysical.
Yeah, that gets difficult. I mean, clearly there's a relationship between the state of the brain and our behavior.
I mean, that is the relationship. I mean,
well, I can't be so quick.
I mean, it's the only identifiable relationship, and clearly my behavior changes if you mess around in my brain.
Clearly it does, to some extent. But you also have people talking about, I feel like I'm a prisoner in my brain. Well, where's that come from? I think that my personhood transcends the organ of my brain, and it's not confined to my brain states. I need to express that person in the way God has so constructed the body. I need to express that person through the functioning of the brain. So if the brain is impaired, then I have an impaired ability to express my person through my body. But that becomes a problem, and we recognize it's abnormal, and we recognize it's pathological. We recognize it's an impairment.
But I mean, that's just an idiom. I say I feel like a prisoner in my brain or a prisoner in my body or something like that. That's just an idiom for talking about being trapped, being confined. I don't know that I would attribute
if your
philosophical value
is
to
only
that.
Is nothing other than your brain states. How do you explain that?
I think it would be an idiom that is analogous to a feeling.
So just a weird feeling that.
Well,
okay.
You would have a feeling about being trapped or
okay,
something
the other,
like that.
The other possibility is that it's someone trying to describe an actual conscious reality. I cannot be through my body who I know that I am and who I am. I cannot be that person through my body.
So what is your explanation for hit me over the head hard enough, I could drastically change?
Because the organ in the body, the physiological mechanism that God created to be the means by which we translate who we are into things we say, things we do, and so on, has been impaired, is broken.
So the patterns of behavior are different.
Right.
That's
the patterns of behavior.
Describe it that way, right?
That's right. That's right.
But I mean, it can drastically change. I mean, you can have an old woman who gets in a car accident.
God who created me can create an impaired version of me, right? And he knows the difference. Mm-hmm. He can compare the impairment to the standard of the concept of me that he had in mind. I mean, it's not a problem for him to make me do impaired things rather than unimpaired things.
Well, certainly God can do that, but the mechanism is still your brain. That's not something. If God does that, then fine, God metaphysically does that. But the identifiable form, mechanism, whatever, is your brain.
Okay, this is at the heart of the issue.
I'm not saying there needs to be a mechanism, because I don't begin with that assumption that there needs to be a mechanism. But I'm saying that is the identifiable mechanism in the situation, your brain.
Okay, granted, and we can all agree with that. I mean, that, you know, I'd have to deny empirical reality to deny that, right? But is that all there is? Just because there's a mechanism, does that exhaustively describe everything that exists? Or is there something that transcends my body and my mechanism, an idea that is informing what's happening in my body and in and through that mechanism? But
so you're making the idea an intermediary between God and the mechanism.
Yeah, it transcends the material world. And is more real than my body.
It actually exists. Well, I mean, God can operate out of ideas and create mechanistic realities, but then when we look at those ideas, that seems to be secondhand, that is extracted from the fact that God has done this. So my personality changes because I get hit over the head. Someone identifies that, comes to an idea about that, looks at that pattern, and they extract an idea, they form an idea, and doesn't mean their idea is wrong, but I'm not sure that idea has to be some kind of like intermediary angel or something, you know.
Okay, well, did we extract it because it was first put there, or are we, like the nominalist says, are we creating it?
It wouldn't be
that. Are we seeing a pattern that's my invention, or are we discovering a pattern that actually has been put there first? And I'm arguing it's the latter.
Well, it wouldn't be that we're creating it. I think we are naming it. We're naming something that we're recognizing objectively in the outside world.
Okay, well, if you're recognizing it in the outside world, where did it come from?
Sure, you can say that it came from God.
Right.
And that God is... But I guess you're talking about person. Mm-hmm. I'm saying your person is your brain, because if I mess with your brain, I change your person.
Well, I'm not accepting that premise.
And you're not accepting that premise.
You're not changing my
There's person. Other things you need to talk about, so we'll talk about this.
Okay. We're almost one more question, and Tobias, I want to give you a chance to follow up on your question. But.
Just the idea of personhood. It seems to me that choosing any particular way that your personality is at a particular time, that's not a good way to define your person, because the drastic change that can happen if you get your head banged could happen, the same change could happen over a period of 20 years as you change more slowly. And I don't know that the time elapse and the choices involved are going to negate the fact that it's still the same person before and after the change, even if the personality changes. And I hope I'm not splitting hairs here, but it seems to me that there's other traumas, non-physical traumas, that can change a person just as much as hitting yourself over the head can. You know, we know people who've had some sort of emotional trauma that fundamentally changed their personality, and we never go, well, we say metaphorically, oh, they're a different person now, but we don't mean they're a different person. We just mean they're very changed. So I think that there's that to consider as well.
Yeah, because ultimately what makes a person is a character playing a role in a story. That's ultimately the essence of what makes a person a person. And in the exigencies of that story, as things change, they may go through drastic transformations of, as you say, personality, but it's still, they're one in the same character in their particular story going through everything that they've had to go through in their life. And how they respond to it and how it affects them is all part of that story. Did Tobias want to follow up?
Okay, so he says, are you saying that God has created us as persons apart from us existing as bodies, and bodies are merely a flawed material that is used to manifest our created soul?
No, I'm not saying that. No, unlike the Greeks... In the Bible, you never have a disembodied existence. To create me is to create me with a body. I will, and when I get recreated in the new heavens and the new earth, I will have a body, a glorified body, a spiritual body, he says in 1 Corinthians 15, as opposed to an earthly body. So there's an entirely different kind of body, but you never have any indication. You do in Christian tradition, but you don't in the Bible ever have any suggestion that I ever spend any amount of time with a disembodied existence. So no, I don't think God created me, a disembodied me, and then gave me a bad body. I mean, he did give me a bad body, rather when he created my body, he was creating me. And he created me to always, for all time, have a body. He's going to give me a new body, so where this body is simply the seed for the glorious flower of a body that I will have one day, but it's still going to be a body. Okay, I've kept you over, so we'll finish up Plato next week.